I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I extend my respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners that we have joining us. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Dead silence. Not because we didn't want to talk about it. It was so raw and we were just holding back tears. So like, I just couldn't talk because I knew that I would cry and I didn't want to cry. I wanted to like pretend everything was okay so that they wouldn't get upset. And I think they were doing the same for me. Yeah. So we all just sat there dead quiet.
Drew Harrisburg is an exercise physiologist, sports scientist, diabetes educator, and most importantly, in his words, a happy and healthy guy thriving with type 1 diabetes. Drew was diagnosed with diabetes at 22, which became the catalyst for an exploration into dietary approaches and physical lifestyle changes to manage his condition. Drew provides a plethora of resources and education around fitness, health, and well-being, which we certainly get stuck into today. But what I was more interested about was uncovering Drew's belief systems, the dreams of a younger Drew. We also chat about creative pursuits, the importance of healthy, loving relationships, society's view on aging, and more. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and hearing Drew reflect on his story so far. Let's get into the chat. This is Life Chats, deep and meaningful conversations with friends and strangers. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. I'm excited.
Me too.
Nervous.
I know. So I've known you like from afar for a little bit, but I feel like I don't really know Drew at the core and like what you stand for in your story. I kind of know top level what you've been through with diabetes. But for people who are listening, what would you say, how would you kind of sum up your mission?
I love this. I just asked you the same question before offline.
Okay.
Like the mission statement.
Yeah.
My mission, wow, it's changed over the years. Are you talking on like a personal level as in what I'm giving out to the world?
Yeah, or, both.
Yeah, it's changed a bit over the years. But I would say if you look at me online, what you would see is somebody who is an educator and sharing just like an honest take of my journey mm-hmm. in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So giving education and information, trying to improve people's lives because I know what it feels like to have your health taken away. I will say though, now that we're opening up,
yeah.
I definitely don't share enough of the downside, the darkness of living with diabetes.
Why is that? Is that a conscious choice that you don't want to share negativity online?
Part of it is that. Part of it is because I know my position as a role model. I know that there's young kids with diabetes and their parents who found me and I'm the beacon of light. Mm. I'm the, you know, the example of
the quote, happy guy living with diabetes
right,
on the website.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Happy and healthy guy thriving with diabetes. That's sort of like the tagline.
Mm.
But I also know that not sharing that stuff is also a disservice to many people. So it's important to share both. I'm trying harder to talk about that stuff more. But I'm finding my feet in that space. It's a bit tricky.
It is tricky, especially when you start to, as you say, you grow a platform where people expect a certain type of content. You know, someone that I used to work for would say the same thing. I'm known for being positive and for kind of always seeing the silver lining, but I have terrible days too. And I feel like I am not being honest by not sharing them. But at the same time, I've created a standard for myself where that would be strange if she did. But
But I actually think that what you just said there, honesty is the most important part. So
totally,
forget about the brand that you have and your appearance and what people expect from you, because at the end of the day, no matter what you share, some people are going to be unhappy with or offended by it. Others are going to love it. So if you're curating yourself and trying to create this 100%. Brand, then yeah, you can appease half of your audience, but just if you just be you, it's so much easier.
And I even find like I don't have a platform at all. I have like 4,000 followers and I feel called to jump on my stories and share how I'm feeling or speak really candidly. And even with such a small following, I'm like, what will people think of me? How will this change people's perception of me and who I am?
Mm.
And it's like, quote unquote, not perfection. Like I have that very high standard.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine what that feels like on such a large scale, particularly when there's like money involved because your platform might be your income. Like there's just a lot of pressure around upholding certain standards, which is hard.
Yeah. I'm also aware of how like annoying it can look.
Do you think?
Well, I think for like, so I do think that maybe it's just me like projecting, but sometimes I'm like annoyed at myself for making diabetes look too easy. Because it's fucking hard. Mm. Like it's full-time job. You basically get assigned a job that you didn't put your hand up for and you can't quit. It's there with you every single day. So like sometimes I look at my content and I'm thinking, am I making this look too easy and like unachievable and unattainable for people? And then are they going to get annoyed and resent? Like, look at this guy just, you know, he's showing off his body. I never wear a shirt. I bought this on the way over. No. But like,
you might do a Simon and start doing some topless podcasts.
I pitched that to him. He wasn't keen. So I sometimes think sharing only the good all the time, even though it is authentic. This is really me. I'm a happy, positive person. But I don't share enough of the times when I'm in the dark.
Of course, and that's human nature. It would be unusual if you didn't experience that side of life too, which I do want to get into that later today. But I think for context, maybe let's go back. You don't have to tell your story in detail because people can find that elsewhere, and I'm conscious we have limited time today. But what I ask a lot of guests is for little Drew or you as a child, I would love to know, did you have a vision for like what you thought your life would be? Or was there like, when I grow up, I want to be a...
Yeah.
What was that for you?
Yes. So when I was about, I'm going to say 12 or 13, my parents bought me my first ever CD, right? Mm-hmm. It was a Jack Johnson CD. And I remember, because before that, or I would listen to like top 40 on the radio or whatever bullshit was playing. But this was the first time that I like physically had a CD. And this was back in the days where you had to like insert it into the car.
Sanity. You know? You'd go to the CD store and put your,
Literally it was hybrid. That was the experience, right? Yep. Went in there. Left the CD, put it in the car and hit play with like good speakers. And I was like, this is the best sound I've ever heard. Like I can't, like Jack Johnson.
What
just
was the song?
It.
Do you remember?
It was that, is it Brush Fire Fairy Tales?
So it was the opening song
on that. Yeah. So I hit that and I was like, holy shit, I want to be
it's a
musician. Yeah. I was like, this is it. I want to be a musician. So my parents bought me a guitar like literally a week later. Mm-hmm. Taught myself how to play acoustic guitar. I wrote a song when I was 12 years old.
It's amazing.
Which was the funniest thing because I still remember it. So cringe.
Sing us a line.
No, I'm not going to sing it, but I'll tell you one of the lines. The funniest part about this line is I wrote a song about what I thought you were meant to talk about in a song. So I wrote about my wife and kids. But I was 13 years old, right? So this song was about my wife and kids, and my wife left me, and the kids were waving at me through the window. Like, this, it was hilarious because I was just conditioned by what I'd seen on TV or whatever.
Country music.
Yes. So anyway, at that point, my whole idea about my future was that I was going to be a singer-songwriter.
Amazing.
And I did pursue that quite a bit. Like, in my early 20s, that's all I did.
Is that still a little bit of a dream?
Yeah, I'm in a dream.
Like, are you actually actively working towards making that happen? Or I could have been that.
Yeah.
You're not that old. You could still
I know.
Do it.
No, I'm not saying it's over, but on the list of priorities, it's not at the top. However, I will say this. I have been in the studio over the last 6 months and
amazing.
I've recorded a song, which is, it's nearly there.
It's okay.
I will release it. I've released two already on Spotify.
Perfect.
No one's heard them. They've made me about $1.50.
Are they under your name?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to start getting the word out there.
Okay, maybe we can put it in the episode.
Like, life's too short, right? You got to follow your creative gifts. Even like this for me, I really don't have a large listenership, but I feel so called to do it.
Yeah.
And I'd rather feel like at the end of my life, I think my greatest driver is that I will be able to say, at least I gave that a crack. Like, it's not this like little dying dream in my soul that when I'm sitting in my rocking chair when I'm 95, I'm like, I wish I did that thing, you know? I just want to be able to say, I tried it.
And like, what's the worst that can happen? We have a great conversation and a few people here and so what? Yeah.
Particularly with a creative endeavor, I feel like what's the worst that can happen? If people want to like shit on your creative endeavors, then they're probably not game enough to do it themselves.
True.
But I think the world is never like saturated with that sort of content. It always is meaningful. It's always impactful.
Right. If you knew that this conversation would improve the life of 5 people,
Even one.
You'd still do it.
100%.
Right. So you're right.
Same with the song.
It's the same. Exactly. Well, that's why I record the songs because I'm proud of them. Mm-hmm. I think they're really good and it's an amazing outlet.
I was going to say, it's probably more important for you to like lean into that process too, to like trust yourself and be able to say like, I feel called to create something and I'm going to create it. I'm not going to judge myself and I'm not going to, you know, tell myself it's not good enough. I'm just going to do it because I love doing it.
And most of the things that I sing about or write about in my music, I wouldn't say
exactly
out loud to a person.
Totally. That's
but when you disguise it with music and lyrics, it just feels like it's so much easier to let it out. Yeah. Mm.
Wow, I'm keen to listen. I'm going to get off this and I'm going to start pumping it loud on the speakers.
Add it to your playlist.
I will.
get my listener count up.
I'll make it the intro music of this podcast.
Oh, please do.
Funny. Tell me about what your home life was like, because you mentioned you came from a family of doctors. Was health and well-being something that was really a conscious choice in the household?
Yeah, absolutely. So my mum is a GP. Mm-hmm. My dad is an eye surgeon. Mm-hmm. My sister's also a doctor. And like I've got an uncle who's a doctor, two uncles who are doctors. My grandfather was a doctor, just medical family.
Did you feel pressured to be that?
Very much. Mm. Like debilitating after school. Mm. So after school, I didn't take a year off. I went straight to uni. But in the break, in that summer break before uni started, I went to, where did I go? Southeast Asia.
Yeah, amazing.
And while I was over there, so like Cambodia and Laos. While I was over there, I got a message from my parents saying that they had signed me up for the medical exam, right? To get
the
into
the UMAT.
Yes, the UMAT.
I did it.
You did it?
Mm-hmm. Horrible.
The worst day of my life.
Off the back of your HSC, the anxiety and stress to then go into that. Like what?
No, but picture this. 3 months in Southeast Asia.
Yep. Living your best life.
Let's just say I wasn't looking after my health. Okay. I didn't have diabetes at this point either. So I was a bit loose. I was a bit of a naughty kid. Mm-hmm. Get back with zero prep. I go to this UMAT and I hated the idea of being there. I didn't want to do it, but I thought, you know, I'll give it a crack. Imagine if I am smart enough to get, of course, you're not smart enough to pass the UMAT without preparing for it, right? So I went through that process, didn't qualify, whatever you call it. And then I started to like fucking resent the fact that I was like getting nudged towards, sorry, mum, if you're listening to this, but I was hating on my parents for pushing me down that path. And makes I felt sense. A lot of pressure. Wrote a song about it because that's the only way I could let it off my chest. So yeah, it was like tons of pressure, but I ended up in a similar space. Mm. You know, I'm still in the health professional space.
Did you enjoy it at the start, or was it something that you were like, okay, I can't be a doctor, so I'll do this to appease my parents?
No, it was enjoyable. It's what I wanted to do.
That's good.
I know it was like a slight downgrade from being a surgeon, but I'm super happy with the path I chose. You know, I look at the life, the work that my parents put in, and my sister currently, she's doing emergency doctor at a hospital, doing night shifts with three kids.
Huge.
And then look, compared to us, like we're sitting in a podcast studio. And I look at the lifestyle and I think, you know, I didn't have it in me to be a doctor. So I chose the right path, that's for sure. But I think that pressure in the beginning drove me away from academics and being super focused on career to rather exploring other things, and it's probably, you know, may have been a benefit in many ways.
Probably being very formative to like who you are and the work that you do.
Definitely.
That you had those experiences.
Yeah, 100%.
Let's talk about values in the home. Do you think that from an exercise physiology and just general health and well-being perspective, do you think that psychology in a home about eating and exercising around those themes really infiltrate a child's behavior later in life? It's the whole like nature versus nurture debate. Mm. I guess I'm just interested in thinking about, you know, who you are today and if your behaviors were really influenced at that age.
So I would say that the home environment, of course, it's going to shape who you end up as or who you become. But in saying that, I think my parents did a really good job of not being militant about health. Because if I think about the way I grew up, I was just like any other kid. There was no restrictions of what I could or couldn't eat, but like my school lunches were healthy. Yeah. So they looked, like the parents are planting the seeds in a way that will allow it to grow later. So I remember I'd show up for school lunch and I would have like five pieces of fruit, some vegetables,
a sandwich.
No, well, I would have maybe one or two little things, but my friends would have like a bag full of junk food.
Yeah.
And they would trade their junk food, and I was happy eating fruit. And, you know, there was no restrictions on if I wanted to have whatever, the Pringles or whatever the fuck it was, I could do that.
Totally.
So I think that they did a really good job with that. I also think that you grow up with a lot of anxiety, though, around the possibility of getting chronic conditions or diseases.
Did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because your parents were doctors?
Yeah, because like, let's say I had like a little lump on my neck that was an absolute nothing.
Yeah.
My mom's like x-ray vision. Yeah. She could like see it. She would be like, there's a lump in your neck, let's go get it tested.
Right.
And she could just like sneak you in to get an ultrasound like the next day.
Do you think that now you have a bit of hypochondria? Like, do you have any hypochondriac tendencies?
Okay. You want me to open up? Here we go.
Here we go.
So after I was diagnosed with diabetes, which obviously was a shock and came out of nowhere and I wasn't expecting it, the next 12 months was like I was living on edge, waiting for the next thing. I thought I had every cancer you could imagine. Like everything was a problem. Like a little freckle, I was like, I've got melanoma. Mm-hmm. Mom, I got melanoma. Or I got a source, like a bit of a pain here. I've got liver cancer. Mom. Mm-hmm. And I was just constantly waiting. Like, what's the next thing that I'm going to get diagnosed with, you know?
I can understand.
And you've got parents who, this is the thing, like ignorance really is bliss. Because if you don't know about these conditions and how they look and you know, you don't know what to look for.
Exactly.
But when you've got sets of eyes on your body all the time, you start to like overanalyze little tiny things that may be totally innocuous and then you think it's something. So for about a year, yeah, I was a mess, like mentally, like I was a mess.
I've been there, probably not on that level, but I spent 3 months in Southeast Asia and I was extremely unwell, like lost 15 kilos, had all these parasites. I was just literally so unwell. Mm. And because I was over in Southeast Asia and I had no real comfort or feeling that I could just access a doctor, I was in like rural Thailand where there wasn't even like a general store to get, like I was living in family stays where they were cooking and everything for me. And I would get pains in the back and I'd be like, I have kidney like disease. Like I'm going to die tonight. I have to text my mom and tell her, like, if I don't wake up tomorrow, I love you. Like these crazy anxious thoughts. But I think it's definitely a spiral. Like you just get on that train and it's very hard to kind of get yourself out of that. So what worked for you?
Yeah, I think the things that ground you are, so the things that brought me back to like a healthy headspace were, number one, knowing that each time I investigated one of these things, it was nothing.
Exactly. And after, to prove to yourself.
Then after a while, I was like, wow, I really have manifested these things and they don't exist. They're made up.
Totally.
And then you start sort of realize that you actually can take control of your health to quite a large degree based on your lifestyle choices. And then I was like, you know what? As long as I'm doing everything I can right, surrender to the process. Like it's going to unfold how it unfolds. I still might get something terrible one day, but at least I'm doing everything I can and enjoying the process.
And you prove to yourself that you're resilient. But as you said, that's an extremely empowering choice to make. Like I'm in control of, for a large part, most of my health. Like there are going to be things that come up that I can't control, but that's life. There's always things that come up that throw you off balance, but you've got to have faith that you have the skills and the resilience and the strength and the relationships and all those things to kind of help you through those times.
Yeah. And just one more thing. So like growing up in a household of doctors, I think what happens is you become hyper-focused on these small things, which builds anxiety. But then this is where it sort of was a curse, is after multiple years of like looking into stuff and waiting for the next thing to happen, I went the other way to like,
I don't care anymore.
Mm. Not just I don't care anymore. I'm in control. I'll be fine. Right. So then I'm leaning away from medical support.
With a chronic condition too.
So as a diabetic, I'm just going to open up here about this as well. I haven't spoken about this much.
Sure.
You're meant to see an endocrinologist pretty much every 3 months. That's like your doctor who is guiding you through your diabetes. I saw an endocrinologist for the first, say, I don't know, year after getting diagnosed, but I've had diabetes for 12 years. I have not seen an endocrinologist. Let's just say
your parents are screaming listening to this. Or do they know?
They know.
Yeah.
I haven't seen an endocrinologist for a long time.
Why?
It's not. Because I lost faith in the system to a point, because I was experimenting with certain dietary approaches to try and manage my diabetes. And my endocrinologist at the time hated the idea of them. And she was telling me basically, I'm doing it wrong. You're ruining your health. And she was actually kind of right. But I still wanted the support of someone to say, listen, I don't think this is a good idea, but... and this is what I recommend, but if you want to go do your thing, just keep coming back. We'll check that everything's all right.
Exactly.
But I didn't get that. So I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm just going to do this on my own. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing a pretty damn good job, but
I think you are.
I need to sort of lean back into that medical system. And
do you think that there is potentially a denial there around acknowledging that you have a chronic condition and that you have to go see a doctor every 3 months? Is that something you'd rather not kind of consciously think about?
No, I don't have a problem with that at all, actually. I mean, I'm very well aware of the potential consequences of poorly managed diabetes. I just think that if my diabetes management sucked, first thing I would do is go to the endocrinologist.
Totally.
But because I'm doing really well, like if you look at the numbers, like my management is very good. My health markers are great. By the way, just because I haven't seen an endocrinologist doesn't mean I'm not like still getting other medical advice.
Totally.
Like my mum's a freaking doctor.
And
my dad. So she does my blood tests.
Yeah.
And every time they come back, they go to her. She's the GP.
Totally.
So I've got doctors looking over all of my bloods all the time. I'm just not going to the endo, who's meant to be the main point of contact for someone with diabetes. So I'm still
Yeah, figuring it out. Yeah. And I think let's just, like, as we said, not spend too much time on this, but for people who maybe don't know who you are and your story, can you just give us a brief kind of rundown about what kind of led up to you being diagnosed with diabetes?
Yeah.
And potentially people might not even know the difference between T1 and T2. I know there's some misconception that you can heal diabetes and people aren't aware that it's an autoimmune condition, it's chronic. Can you just give us kind of that top line info that we need to know to understand your story?
Yeah, sure. So I was only diagnosed when I was 22, right?
Is that a common age?
It used to be known as juvenile diabetes, so you would get it as a kid. So you can get it as a toddler or as a baby. You're not born with it. So it's an autoimmune disease. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. The pancreas is destroyed by your own immune system, right? So if you have type 1, you don't produce insulin at all. Mm-hmm. So you have to either inject it or you wear a pump.
And like, you can't heal that.
You cannot reverse it.
Like any autoimmune disease, my mom has Crohn's disease. Right. Like that is for her the rest of her life.
Some people have had like pancreatic transplants and reversed it. Mm-hmm. But other than that avenue, you can't, like your lifestyle doesn't reverse it.
Yeah.
The attack's done. You the cells are destroyed. You can't produce insulin. Mm-hmm. So I was only diagnosed when I was 22. And basically leading up to that, life was, amazing. Like as good as it gets, grew up in Bondi. Chased the singer-songwriter career, signed with a modeling agency when I was like 18 and worked all through my 20s.
Incredible.
That was just like, it was the best. It was such a cool.
Too good to be true.
It was too good to be true, yeah. Mm. And then anyway, I get this diagnosis when I'm 22 in the midst of getting my accreditation to be an exercise physiologist. And this part of the story is like, I can laugh about it now, but it's not funny. I had all the signs and symptoms of diabetes, but I didn't know what they were, what to look for. And anyway, I was sitting in an interview, a job interview at a hospital to try to get a position there to get my accreditation. And I fell asleep while talking to the guy who's trying to get me into this thing, right? Like face to face at a desk like this, just dozing off. Mm. Same day, falling asleep, driving home in my car, like really exhausted, lost heaps of weight, felt terrible, looked terrible, health was deteriorating.
Were your parents worried at this point? Like when I kind of noticing there was something that was wrong?
You know what? I think my willpower got me through that period. So like I was still training, I was still showing up and working, I was still playing gigs, I was doing everything, but I was suffering in silence. Like I was falling asleep all day, every day. Like I'd get home and I would just sleep for 5 hours in the middle of the day. That's when my mom was like, "What? He's sleeping a lot. This is kind of strange." Like, or I'd go over to visit them and I'd just sleep for 5 hours and they'd be like, what is he doing? And I was like drinking heaps of water because you get really thirsty when you have high blood sugar. So they knew something was wrong. Blood tests revealed pretty much within a couple of weeks that I might get diabetes. I didn't have it at that point. That's the weird thing. So on paper, I didn't actually have it, but I had the antibodies that showed that I was under attack, so to speak.
Is that just, sorry to interrupt your train of thought there, but is that like with any autoimmune condition, once the kind of domino gets hit and all the antibodies start to occur and the chain reaction begins in the body, is that something that can be halted or stopped, do you think? Or it's like once those antibodies are there, that's the ultimate kind of result?
They showed me some odds. Like they basically give you a chart. They're like, okay, if you have these antibodies but you have a normal fasting blood glucose and you don't have diabetes yet, your chances of getting it are XYZ.
Yeah.
So my chances were 25%. I had a 25% chance of developing type 1.
Were you worried by that number?
Oh, it was terrible. Yeah, because it was limbo. Like I didn't know. I was like, 25%, it's kind of high, like 1 in 4. And then it was the hardest part was they say, could be 5 years, could be 5 days, could be tomorrow. Mm. We don't know. We just got to keep an eye on it. So then you're sent home trying to keep an eye on this. You're just wondering, is this the day? And every day you wake up, you're like, is it today? And you check, you do the finger prick. It's like, is this the day? No. Thank you. And then the next day, it's coming. You think it's coming. Mm. Some people, it never happens. For me, it happened. I remember checking my blood glucose one morning and it was above the range they said. They said, if it's above 5 or 5.5, it's a little bit of a problem. Above 7 and you're pretty much, we know. And it was 7 point something. And I was like, full denial. I was like, no, there's no way. It can't be. Anyway, went to the clinic, did a finger prick with them in person and I got the diagnosis like in the clinic. So, I mean, just like that.
Was anyone with you in the clinic?
Yeah. So my dad, who is an eye surgeon who spends most of his career like helping people with diabetes, which is a crazy irony, to essentially.
That would have been hard for him because he was seen the kind of worst case scenarios.
That's right. Exactly. He'd seen like full blown blindness from poorly managed diabetes. I mean, it takes decades to get to that level, but getting the diagnosis with him there, he would have, I mean, I can only imagine what he actually felt like.
Do you remember having like what that first conversation was like on the way home in the car or any sort
dead
of
silent
Just silence.
Dead silence. Not because we didn't want to talk about it. It was so raw and we were just holding back tears. So like, I just couldn't talk because I knew that I would cry and I didn't want to cry. I wanted to like pretend everything was okay so that they wouldn't get upset. And I think they were doing the same for me. Yeah. So we all just sat there dead quiet that night. Whoa, the tears flowed hard. Mm. And then, yeah, the next day things turned around pretty quick.
But what did you think, like in that moment, for anyone who is diagnosed with a chronic condition, like what is your mind thinking in that moment? Like, what did you think the future looked like for you in that room?
Yeah, I'm trying to go back there in my head. So the very first thing was like, why me? What did I do to deserve this? Yeah, like what did I do to get this? And I mean, that's such a stupid thing to think because life's unfair to everyone.
Like, but you're essentially a kid too. Like, that's a pretty huge
young,
thing to
20,
go.
21, 22. Yeah. Yeah, it's quite, especially when you contrast it with where I was at just before that.
Exactly.
Top of the world.
Yeah.
Life was too good. Traveling, working, playing gigs, you know, not the best life. I still do have a great life, by the way. But yeah, it was the why me. It was like, life's over. Like, this is it. I'm done. Like, life sucks. You actually say, I saw the world differently. And I'm not just saying like metaphorically, like literally the color of the world changed. It's very hard to explain to somebody.
Wow.
Unless you've ever got a diagnosis that feels like your life's over, something happened. Like the world looked different. And okay, obviously everything came back. But in that moment, I truly believed that like, this is it. I may as well just die. Like there's no point in living. Not that I was having suicidal thoughts. I mean like,
but like it was that
from a philosophical point of view.
Totally.
Yeah.
Especially because it's unknown too. You don't really know how it's going to play out for you. Like what if you are that worst case person that your dad has to operate on? Like,
well, there's
your
even
mind
worse
goes there.
There's a lot worse than that, but
you
can die, right? So that's what the team at the clinic tell you. They're like, listen, this is what can happen if you don't manage your diabetes properly. Blindness, kidney disease, foot amputation, seizure, coma, death. And it's like, fuck.
Great.
You know?
Thanks for that.
Yeah. So, but they also do say, but you can also live a really good, long, healthy life if you look after yourself, blah, blah, blah. But the whole look after yourself piece, that's where it's confusing because it's
totally.
Like,
you
where
have
do
no
I start?
Education.
No education.
And luckily you have resources and a medical family. Imagine if you had nothing, no knowledge of medicine
think about
at
that.
All.
I always think about that. Imagine like—
Where would you start?
Low SES, uneducated, no income, you get this diagnosis. That can be something that really ruins your life.
Totally.
And going back to our first conversation where I'm like, am I sometimes portraying this as too easy? I often think about the people who are not in my privileged position to manage it the way I do. And I think, are they looking at this and going, mate, you have no idea how hard this really is. Yeah, you just don't get it. Like diabetes, you say diabetes improved your life. Well, it fucking ruined my life. You know, is that what someone else is thinking? Probably. But I'm still me and I have to live my life.
Totally.
Like I can't
not have the resources in the family and the job that you have.
Leverage it. Right. Like that's just where I am. And, I know I'm in a privileged position. But I also think that the tools that I teach are accessible to pretty much everyone.
That's amazing.
Like the move your body piece of it. You don't have to have an expensive gym membership. Mm-hmm. You don't have to live in Bondi. Like you can literally move your body right now. I don't care where you are.
Do squats and push-ups kind of
go for a walk around
your house if you have to.
So there's always a way to move, right?
Yes.
That's an easy message.
Yes.
The nutrition message can be a little complicated because some diets may be more privileged than others, right? Simon and I have spoken about this quite a bit.
It's very difficult to kind of angle healthy eating and healthy habits when some people can't even afford to put food on the table, let alone healthy options.
Right. Imagine you've got six kids, you're a single mom, you're working the only job to bring in the income, you've got to feed all of your kids.
It's also time and convenience too. A lot of people say, healthy food is cheap if you buy,
beans,
whole foods.
And rice.
Yeah. But like what busy mom who's working three jobs has time to slave away in the kitchen? Like McDonald's on the way home is convenient.
Right.
It keeps kids calm and happy because they've got food in their bellies.
Right.
Like at a survival level,
exactly.
I don't think we can be passing judgment on diets or exercise for people who are genuinely in that position.
100%. Yeah. Like the idea of coming home to six kids, just the chaos in the house, you're tired from work. A frozen meat pie is a really simple way to shut the kids up, let them eat.
It's also just food. Like for some people, it's literally just a meal.
Right.
That's what they need. They need a meal. So it's hard because you would have people, I imagine, following you that you work with that come from both ends of the spectrum.
Mm.
So there's so many ways I want to take that.
Mm.
What I really want to know is, what have been the lowest points in your journey? Because this is how many years ago? 10 years ago? 8 years ago? 12. Sorry, I thought you were 28 for a moment.
12, thank you.
No, so what have been some of the lowest moments, and do you think they were triggered by anything in particular? I mean, we all have down days where we're just kind of like, woe is me, whether you have a chronic condition or not. But for you, was there any particular events in life that triggered a really depressive episode around having diabetes?
Definitely the early days. So I reckon the first 6 months, I hate to use this word because I wasn't diagnosed in this way, but I think I had depression for at least 6 to 12 months.
What were the symptoms of that for you?
Did not want to be seen in public. Didn't want to socialize. Like, I had no social life. I just wanted to re-identify, like, who am I now? Feel confident in my body.
Were you single at that point?
No, I was in a relationship, but it ended a couple of years after, I think. So for the first 2 years, I was in a relationship with diabetes, which actually helped.
Extra support. I was just thinking that definitely would probably helped. Be a good thing.
Yes. But it also meant that I didn't lean on my friends. Because I was like, I'm fine. I'm good on my own and I've got a girlfriend. I don't need my friends. And that was a problem because they were trying to help and reach out. And I was like, guys, I don't want to fucking see you. I don't want to talk to you. Stop inviting me places.
It's too hard.
They would invite me out for dinners and drinks and this and that. And I would just be like, it was always a no. And that was because I didn't want to talk about diabetes. I didn't want to check my blood glucose in public. I'd go to the bathroom to do it. I didn't want to inject insulin in front of anyone. I'd go to the bathroom. I didn't want anyone to see it.
What was the shame around it for you?
It wasn't shame. It was, I didn't have the energy to talk about it. I was exhausted. I'm trying to minute by minute, I'm riding this roller coaster of mood fluctuations based on my blood glucose. So I'd see a high blood sugar and I'd be like, fuck. Blood glucose
and put
is
yourself
high.
Down and say, tell yourself that you're not good enough for not managing it properly.
Come on, mate, you're better than this. Get it right. It was so hard. Diabetes is so, I didn't know this at the time. I thought I'd figure it out. It's so bloody hard. So yeah, I mean, I was down. I didn't want to be seen. And I was just in hiding, I reckon, for a year or two. And then I started to find some confidence because firstly, I'd lost 15 odd kilos. So I was 68 kilos when I got diagnosed. But 6 months before that, when I was playing rugby, I was 85. So I was I felt like a skeleton, right?
Yeah.
Took time to build back, but I rebounded and got actually pretty fluffy, because that's what happens, right? So you've lost all this weight, your metabolism slows down because you're basically starving for 6 months when you have undiagnosed diabetes, even though you're eating.
Wow.
It's the nutrients aren't going into your cells.
Absorbed.
Yeah. So that you just urinate them out, glucose, you just piss it out.
Wow.
Or it's just building up in your bloodstream.
And your muscles obviously waste away when you
don't have
that.
Muscles waste away.
Sort of, yeah.
Exactly. So I was really, really, really skinny.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take insulin and the opposite happens. You just pack on weight so fast, right? And I went the other way. So then I got kind of overweight for me. Wasn't getting any modeling work at that point because I looked like...
I was going to say, for someone whose career at this point was based around your body, did you kind of feel that this was starting to lean into body dysmorphia territory?
100%. The numbers of eating disorders in people with type 1 is through the roof. There's some stats on
that.
Through the roof. Because it's a condition directly related to every meal you eat. You have to count carbs, fat, protein, how much insulin do I need to give to get the meal in. Some people gain weight from using insulin. So then a lot of women most of the eating disorders are actually in women with diabetes. So dangerous. Because this is really dangerous. They purposely don't take their insulin so that they lose weight. But then that means their diabetes is very poorly managed and then they develop complications. So it's terrible. It's very tough. So I mean, there were days where I wouldn't eat a meal because I wanted to keep my blood sugar in range. I was like, I don't want to mess this up. I'm just going to skip lunch and stay in range for longer. And then I get to the end of the lunchtime and I'm still in range. I'm like, you know what? Fuck, I'm not going to eat dinner.
Yeah.
And I did that for forever. And then I was over-exercising in combination with that.
To try and keep your sugar.
Keep my sugar down. And then that crashed my testosterone. That made my mood. That was probably also why I was so anxious and feeling depressed. I had no testosterone.
And your gut health's probably shot because you're not eating
properly. Yeah. Right. So everything, I just did everything wrong.
Mm.
Which is all part of the experiment. I had to go through this because I learned early on what not to do, which is a big part of the learning. Yeah, I mean, then eventually when I sort of started to gain my muscle back, feel healthy, had really good numbers, good blood glucose control, then I was like, actually, now I'm ready to not just socialize, see my friends. I'm ready to talk about it. I'm ready to inject in public. And I'm ready to start a freaking Instagram account sharing it to the world. That's where I was actually, I'm proud of how I'm managing this.
It's a pretty
this.
Huge decision to go from going to the bathroom to inject your insulin right. to creating an account called Drew's Daily Dose. Like, yeah. it's the opposite it's of the, how you're
It's the opposite, exactly. So when people ask me like, hey, can I ask, do you mind talking? I'm like, of course, let's
That's
go.
What it's there for.
That's what it's there for, yeah.
I want to get into some sort of different territory. Thank you for sharing, by the way. Okay. I know you are very like open and happy to talk about it, but I know that harder stuff can be challenging. One thing that comes to mind is I know that you did a lot of experimentation on your body and around like different diets and whatnot, and you're currently plant-based. For you, and maybe in general, based on science, objectively, what is the best pattern, dietary pattern for someone with diabetes? I know that you tried keto. What else did you try? Paleo, veganism. What do you think is kind of the best way to manage this?
I mean, this is a 10-hour podcast. I'm going to try
this summer. Is a whole podcast season. Like, this is your podcast. Season.
This is actually 20 episodes. Seriously. Okay, let me try to break this down. If you want a pretty quick Band-Aid solution to getting your blood glucose in range and reducing your insulin requirements, going low-carb or keto is going to do that pretty fast, right? Because you're not putting glucose into the system, so you're not going to see
the spikes.
Big spikes, right? But unless you can keep that up long term, i.e. years or forever.
Or your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are going to run into some problems because a low-carb diet worsens your carbohydrate and glucose tolerance and it worsens your insulin sensitivity. So you might have these numbers that look really good, but it's not telling you what's actually going on deeper, right? So if you...
Also, like as we said... keto, high fat, like that's a long-term kind of risk that you're taking.
Right. What are the other risks associated with a very high saturated fat diet, in particular saturated fat? But when you're diagnosed with diabetes, your risk of cardiovascular disease goes up and other diseases. So if you choose a diet that manages your numbers well, but increases your risk of other diseases, it's a trade-off.
Totally.
So it's what are you willing to do? That's the question you got to ask. Now, if you want to sort of move away, so my transition was from that, like a low-carb, high-saturated fat diet to now a lower fat. Still, I'm not low fat, but a lower fat, higher carb, plant-based diet. The keys are you want to try eat more unsaturated fats rather than saturated fats. So your saturated fats like coconut oil, butter, cheese, full fat, animal fatty, you know, cuts of meat, all that sort of stuff, eggs.
What's low saturated fat options for people?
So lower saturated fat would be like more plant-based fats. So like avocado, olive oil, nuts and seeds, exactly. Even like tofu and tempeh have some fat, but it's more unsaturated. So you would want to try lean towards unsaturated fat. You want to eat a lot of fiber. Right. So when I was keto, it was obviously I was trying to do a healthier version of it, which included vegetables and stuff. But a lot of people do keto, which is literally butter in your coffee.
Oh my gosh, the bulletproof coffee.
Bulletproof coffee, eggs and bacon. That's like breakfast. Then they don't eat
with mayo.
With probably mayo and cheese or whatever. Right. So if you're going to go keto, lean on the unsaturated fats and include a lot of non-carby, non-starchy vegetables. If you're going to go plant-based, well, there's a lot of other benefits. So one of the biggest benefits of, and this is for type 1 and type 2 or any kind of diabetes, is your insulin sensitivity will improve when your weight comes down. So if you're overweight and you have type 2 and you have this option called the plant-based diet, which means you can eat whole foods, high fiber, very filling with low energy density, it's pretty easy to lose weight or at least maintain your weight. You feel satiated, you feel quite full, and you're not going to overeat your calories.
You can also have a large volume of food being plant-based.
Big volumes. So for the boys out there who are like, oh, I don't want to, it's a lot of food, a lot of fiber, right?
And isn't it interesting? I don't know if it's the same for you, but often when I cook for people who aren't plant-based, they're like, this is amazing, so tasty, so delicious, so much food. I didn't think it was like this for potentially maybe like older generations or people who aren't health conscious.
What did you think it was like?
Yeah, like do you think I was eating raw carrots and celery and
they did.
Rice? Yeah.
They actually did think that. So yeah, I think a plant-based diet, I mean, there's many other reasons why I like to do it other than the direct influence on diabetes. But most of the time, you're going to be able to manage your weight a bit better. Mm-hmm. It's going to improve your insulin sensitivity and you're testing your system so that you can actually tolerate carbs, right? Because you're not on a high-fat diet. When you're high-fat, your carb tolerance diminishes, but you become a good fat burner.
That's another thing about cutting or like restrictive eating and dieting in a way that you kind of cut out whole food groups. Like for me personally, going through my journey of, you know, cutting out gluten completely, even though I wasn't celiac, I was probably like gluten sensitive.
Why'd you do that?
Because I got all these parasites in Asia and I was just in so much pain. And I noticed that gluten was like the most inflammatory thing for me.
So you notice the difference?
100%. I was literally looked 9 months pregnant. Like I was, my stomach was so sore.
And
that
you definitely ruled out celiac?
Yeah. I've got colonoscopies, endoscopies, everything. As soon as I came back from Asia, my family was like, what is going on? You're going, I literally went from the airport. My mum picked me up. She said I was like gray and skeletal and drove me to hospital.
Wow.
Like in Australia and I was there for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And they did like every test and it came back with like giardia and all these parasites. But I was convinced something else was going on because my mom has Crohn's. So I was like, obviously this is it for me. Like I'm getting that. I couldn't wear pants. I couldn't wear anything that touched my stomach.
Wow.
It was agonizing.
Excruciating pain every day.
The worst pain. Like I literally could not
and
stand
pain
up.
Pain is debilitating. Like
I couldn't stand up. Like if I was standing up, I was in so much pain. And there was just like no answers and anything like that. So I thought I'm going to start experimenting. I'm going to cut everything out and see what's kind of causing the inflammation. And for me, gluten was a huge one.
Interesting.
But
did you cut them out like one at a time?
Cold turkey,
cut it and then add them back in?
The only way I could function during this time was to have a liquid diet.
Wow.
I could not have anything beyond liquids.
Sounds like very Crohn's-y. Like I know a lot of guys with Crohn's who, as long as they're not eating, they feel fine.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
So like it was just liquid diet. And then my mom was kind of steaming me sweet potato. And like I remember eating sweet potato and broccoli. Like that was literally all
That's
I could
bro,
tolerate.
A bro diet.
I know.
Like
a tuna. And then like she would add on little things. But it honestly took me about 2 years of very slowly increasing what I was eating to get to a point where I could have maybe a couple of bites of pasta or pizza once a week without it flaring me. Now I'm at a point where I can eat sourdough. I can eat.
Okay, so you eat gluten now.
I can eat gluten. I'm a little sensitive, but it's not like it doesn't impact my life. But the whole reason I went on this tangent is because I think a lot of people, when they start to take control of their health and their diet and they see potentially trends on social media or they don't have the education, they think like, I'm going to cut these massive food groups out. And then your body actually is unable, for me anyway, to process that. So for me to like bring gluten back in, I didn't have, as my doctor was explaining, the sort of microbiome to be able to do that. I've literally lost the ability to process that food group because I went so long without it.
100%. I did the same
thing. It's been a journey.
I removed gluten as well because early on I was like reading about science and diabetes and
I read that. Yeah, wait, incredible. It's called gut. It's up there somewhere.
I probably read it as well. I read something called like 10% human or
by
something. Similar thing.
Julia Enders.
Okay. So I saw the connection between gut health and type 1 diabetes. Right? And then there was a stat that I read, which is still today, it still exists, which is, we get the stat right, 5% of people with diabetes get celiac as well.
Wow.
It's quite like, I know it's 1 in 20, it's solid.
And then I can only imagine the mental health like repercussions of those conditions.
Right, because it's a food.
Diabetes
is a condition of food anyway. Luckily, like, you know what the gluten-free landscape's like. There's options for everything.
Totally.
But then I was like, oh, so there's a connection here. I'm like, I'm just going to remove gluten. Because back then I was of the mindset that I was definitely going to get celiac.
And you're anxious.
I was
too,
waiting.
So you're like, let's
So I just like, let's just get rid of it now. I'm just going to go gluten-free now because I'm going to get celiac one day anyway. That was my mindset.
I get it.
So I cut gluten now for ages. And I've brought it back into my diet and I'm fine.
I'm like, how did I live without this sourdough?
Oh,
I think that
sourdough.
Now.
Yeah.
Go to Iggy's on a Saturday morning.
Oh, Iggy's.
The best.
Classic.
I'm going to miss that when I go.
Oh, yes. I'll ship some over.
I want to change pace because, I just think for people listening who are interested in your story and who are interested in genuine diabetes education and the more scientific, nuanced conversations, there's so much that you do out there. There's, you know, multiple 2 to 3 hour long conversations that you've done with Simon, amongst others, your episode with, hopefully I can say this, Rich Roll is coming out soon, I think.
Yes,
so
yes.
Keep a lookout for that. But what I want to really talk to you about today is like on a more personal level, your health and well-being. And I think there's more and more research coming out and we need community and we need people. And there are now direct links in scientific literature to relationships, healthy, happy relationships and our mental health and our physical health.
Mm.
Now you've been in a relationship for how many years?
7 years.
Seven.
I think.
So what's the key to like making it work?
Yeah, wow. So as you said, the research on relationships and long-term health is, I mean, it's enormous. So it's got such a big impact. You look at the blue zones, you know, the five areas of the world where people live the longest. Mm. Yes, they eat a predominant diet. Yes, they're active, physically active, but they have huge community.
They're so social.
Connection, social. They're social. Mm. They love life. They have
fun. And
they
have big dinners.
They play.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's like there's purpose and reason to enjoy your life. Mm. Like if you remove that component and you tick all the other boxes, what are you doing it for? Like, is life worth living? Sometimes I think, like, if you become so militant about getting your workouts in every day and getting your step count and sleeping properly and all these, like, manage your stress and da-da-da, that's stressful. for some people.
Checking your.
I love it.
Every 5 seconds.
Right, exactly. especially these days, there's so much data. Mm. You've got the app measuring this and an app measuring that. And some people wearing CGMs that I wear that, you know, don't even have diabetes. So, like,
that's crazy.
Why? You got to ask, like, why are you doing it? Most of the time, you want to be healthy so you can live a long life to be there for your family. Mm. If you're a parent or a grandparent or a partner or whatever, you want to be around to see your kids grow up, right? So I think for me, I don't have kids, but I do have a dog and there's a lot of purpose there.
Do you want kids?
This is a conversation that I would have answered very differently only 5 months ago. So 5 months ago or 6 months ago, I would have said, no, I don't want kids. I'm happy in my relationship. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with my dog and I hope to have dogs forever and many. I am very pessimistic about the world if I were to bring a kid into it. I'm such a positive person for my own life, but I'm so pessimistic.
I think that's a sentiment that our generation honestly shares. We have the highest rates of single women in their 30s and 40s, people not having children, because I think there's this general anxiety and uncertainty about where we're going. And I say that to my parents and they say, you know, people were born during the World War. Like, everyone's always felt anxious about the future. But I think particularly now with things like AI and, you know, the potential of things to go wrong.
Yes.
How connected we are to other civilizations that we weren't before. It's like this impending sense of doom. And I would feel horrible as well if I brought a human into this world who ended up suffering and would say, like, why did you do this to me?
Yes. I look at the world, like you mentioned, AI, just the digital nature of it, TikTok.
Elon Musk.
I imagine like having a daughter who's like
doing living in TikTok.
Yeah, dancing on TikTok with a tripod on the side of the street.
Yeah.
There's a list of reasons why and the climate and then the animal suffering and abuse. And it just goes on and on. Like, that's my pessimistic side. So I was like, I don't want to bring a kid into this world. Then I was thinking, I have the gift of life. My parents gave that to me. If you're a good parent, you should be able to navigate any environment. It just takes good parenting skills, resilience, and you can teach your kid how to be a great kid in this maybe not so great world.
That's an amazing way to look at things.
So then I was thinking, you know what? It's not like I'm definitely not going to have kids. It's just I need to be a really good parent. And I was still like, you know, but I could also just have such a happy life, you know, like I'm with our kids. Like, I'm thinking, I can travel.
Commitment.
Yeah, there's no commitment. I can travel all the time.
Selfish, you can do what you
very
like.
Selfish, focus on my health all the time, all of these things. So I could see both cases. But then roughly 6 months ago, my grandma passed away. She was 93, my mum's mom. It's a positive story in the end. But basically, she was 93 and so sharp, like mentally, like she would have been able to have a 2-hour podcast right now. Like,
woman.
Amazing, amazing woman. She was the matriarch. Mm. She had built a huge family.
Yeah.
Right. So she has 3 kids who all have kids, So she was a great grandmother, great, great grandmother to a massive family, right? Of people that freaking loved her.
And
she was like the, you know, the old elephant, you know, in the herd, whatever it's called. But basically, like, everyone knew that we were here because of her. Mm. She gave us all the gift of life and we loved her. She was so sharp mentally, but physically, unfortunately, her body failed on her, which was the hardest thing to ever watch is somebody who wants to be here, like really wants to be here, doesn't want to die, but knows they're dying. And he's just trying to hold on for just another minute, just to see the kids, right? So anyway, on her deathbed, she was surrounded by family, like 20, 30 people in her room.
It's amazing.
Kids, grandkids, great-grandkids. Everyone was there. She was laughing. Even though she was suffering physically, she would laugh her way through it with so much love just oozing out of her. And I'm thinking the only reason she got to this age is because of the people in her life. She wants to be there to see them. Because we would ask her, we'd say, Gran, are you ready to go? She's like, I'm not.
Oh, wow.
She goes, I don't want to go yet. I'm not ready.
Yeah.
And we'd say, why? She goes, I just want to see my grandbabies.
Oh, wow.
So we just bring them into the room and she'd just smile. She just wanted to look at them, right? And then I think hopefully I'm not in that physical state, but if I one day get into that physical state and I don't have family, I don't have kids, I'm alone. Literally, you die on your deathbed alone. Mm-hmm. No kids. That means no grandkids. That means it's you, right? And especially because one of your partners is going to die first.
Before you.
Right. Mm. So you could literally be on your own in a room. And there was a lot of people in the same ward who were on their own on the deathbed. And I'm thinking, you know, fuck, I think I should probably have kids.
You're like, Carly.
Yeah. So no, we had the conversation. So Carly feels the same. We feel like we can see two great lives. Mm. But now more than ever, we're like, actually, I think we need to have family.
That's amazing. Know?
Yeah. So that all came from seeing my grandma suffer and pass away. But then, like I say, the positive ending is that the only reason she got to 93 in that state is because she wanted to be there to see her family.
Totally. And she had something to live for. Yes. And that positive mindset as well. This is something I talk about with my dad so much. He's an incredibly like wise, philosophical sort of man, but he's also worked in geriatric aged care for his whole life. And I've grown up like being taught the importance of our elders, so to speak, and like learning their stories and learning from them and about them. And he always says every time he sees like an elderly person on the street, like they were young ones too, like they shouldn't be treated any differently. They had stories to tell. They had people around them. And something that I find really interesting that, you know, you're probably aware of is just the way that the healthcare system in Western countries is so inadequate to support the health and well-being of elderly people. We put them in nursing homes. We forget they exist. Mm. We spoke about Europeans before, and I was listening to a podcast with a woman who said her 90-year-old grandmother still walks into town every day to get her groceries. Yeah. She says hi to all her neighbors. They hold massive dinner parties with 12 people. She cooks everything. Mm. There's a sense of community and there's a sense of pride with age and having lived that long. And I think for in Australia particularly, our system is just so broken. We don't see elderly people as something to be proud of.
We have the most valued members.
We forget about them. Right. It's so uncomfortable and it's so hard to navigate that it's like, for me, I think about my pops in a nursing home. It's so painful and uncomfortable to acknowledge the state that he's in that I'll just avoid going rather than being there for him.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot to be said around general health and well-being and the respect that we show for elderly people too.
But also, it's such a good point. Like, you should look at an elderly person and go, fucking, you have been through so much.
Respect.
What can I learn from you?
Totally.
Tell me about how to do this thing called life, and also value their input in the community.
100%. And like they're just forgotten about.
Yeah.
Especially like my dad, I don't know how he does it, but he's just like, if you knew the true nature of the conditions that elderly people are living in nursing homes, it would break
your heart.
They're
treated like literally like objects.
Horrible.
Yeah.
And
I've worked in one.
They're just put in front of TVs and they're just left there all day.
Literally. I worked in one to get my accreditation for exercise physiology. So I did a physiotherapy placement. I did a cardiac rehab placement and I did the old age home. It is not
horrible. It is horrible. Served like horrible food and
they are put in front of a TV. They can't move. They don't have freedom. They're treated like the shell of a human being, but they feel the same as they did when they were 50, 40, 30.
And I think the biggest thing for me, especially being someone who like values storytelling, that's like the crux of my existence, I think, and why I'm here, and to kind of bring human experiences to light, is that these stories will be gone forever. Like if we don't get them out of these people, if we don't write down the recipes, if we don't capture the photos, if we don't ask what was, you know, the war like and what was living in this town like and what was your family like, it's just gone.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
What's the value in not knowing your history and learning from people that have been through things we can't even comprehend, I think.
And think about all of our information is stored digitally now.
Mm.
Let's just say there was a meteorite that hits Earth. Where's the evidence?
Yeah, we have nothing.
We have no evidence of this conversation or that
I'm
we
gonna
had.
Put it on a, I'm going to transcribe it into scroll.
Do you know what I mean? Like this stuff just goes.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yeah.
It vanishes. There's no physical evidence. I just watched this Netflix series. What was it called? Ancient Apocalypse or something. I think it was Graham Hancock. It was like storytelling.
Is it the Egyptian one?
Yeah, it's all about Egypt.
Yeah. It's like top 10 at the moment.
Right. Mm. And you sort of see all these remnants of human, or whatever they were, humans, who lived thousands of years ago and were sort of wiped away. And you've still got evidence. Like there's pictures in stone and there's architecture. With us,
it's scary,
it's
isn't it?
It's all digital. You
know? I even have to like force myself. I did this in lockdown because I actually had time, but I thought I have 40,000 photos on my MacBook. I don't have any printed photos. And like I love sitting down with my family and looking at photos of me as a kid. And like they're printed. And so I thought I'm just going to get all my trips, all my travels around the world.
Great
and
idea.
Put them in photo books so that even if I die, like there's something somewhere
that's such a
for
good
someone.
Idea. Also, it's when it's physically like on a coffee table.
It's the
and
best.
You look at it together.
It's
and
the
you
best.
Flip the pages.
Yeah.
Whilst if you just send it to someone in a text, you're not there to see their reaction.
Exactly.
You don't feel it with them. Yeah. I remember my gran had these books of us like, even her as a kid.
Mm.
I'm like, is that you as a kid? Like, oh, that is crazy.
Yeah, it's
black
special.
And white photo from the 20s, you know, wild.
It's crazy. we'll wrap up shortly.
I'm not in a rush.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. I'm really grateful. Something that I just want to wrap up this kind of aspect of our conversation is like, if you do have kids and whenever that is, what are the kind of key values or lessons that you want to pass on to them? Or what are some sort of things that will be definitely happening in your household, in your home, to create the type of family that you want?
Good question.
Has it been a conversation with Carly, or is this just like off the top of your head?
It's off the top of my head. But these are my values. And whatever my values are, I imagine will be the values of my household and my kids will adopt. Number one, without your own physical and mental health, you cannot be of service to anybody else, right? You need to look after your health. Again, I go back to my grandma. I look at how she ended up physically, you know, lung failure.
Did she smoke?
She smoked for many years. She quit, obviously, you know, maybe in her 50s or 60s, but she'd smoked for many years and the damage had been done. So I saw physically what can happen. You want to avoid that for sure. And to be able to like be your best every day and actually enjoy your life, you want to be feeling good and feel healthy mentally and physically. So health is huge. Mm-hmm. I think being 100% authentic, trying to just be you. Don't try to manufacture the person who you think you should. You've just got to be yourself. I think that's the easiest way because you have to be you anyway. Mm-hmm. And also ask questions. Like this is another thing. So I train these kids who are like in their 12, 13 years old. They have type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
I'll tell them to do a certain exercise or I train them as like an exercise as a coach. Mm-hmm. And they're all, one of the kids is always asking why.
Curious.
Straight away, why, right? His mom, I hope they don't hear this. His mom just says, just do it. Just listen to your coach. That is your superior. You listen. Mm. But I'm actually thinking, and I do tell him this. I'm like, mate, I love that you're asking why. Ask the questions.
It's an amazing life skill.
Yes.
Translates to everything.
Yes. And I remember, have you read Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes, yeah.
So it's the kids who can ask why or question authority that end up doing way better in life.
This always used to happen to me. I was that kid in school. It was like, put your hand down, Georgia. Stop asking why. Right. Like, you don't need to know that level of detail. But I was like, to function, I need to know. I need to know. Like, that's what allows you to push boundaries or do things differently.
Yes.
Or act from a place of authenticity because you believe in what you're doing.
Right. And I will never say, because I said so. If they say why, because I say so. I will never say that.
My mom says that to me.
I hate that. Give a reason.
I'm anti-authoritarian.
Give a good reason. Yeah. If they ask a good question, you should have the answer. If you don't have the answer, you say, I actually don't have the answer to that. Mm. And then you got to reflect. You gaze inwards. Yeah. You figure it out.
I'm not a superhero. I don't know. I'm an adult, but I don't know everything.
Right.
Like that would be very powerful to bring your kids up in that way.
So I think ask questions and question authority. Like I have this like a bit of an anti-authority sort of feel about me. Like I don't like the idea of someone being superior to me, which means I can't even talk to them like a human being. Like to me, everyone's a human. I don't give a fuck if you're the president or if you're the janitor. I'm going to talk to you the same way. And I think that's a value I want to have in my house and in my kids.
Totally. I wonder where that comes from though, because I'm super anti-authoritarian merely by the point, like by the fact that someone tells me what to do, I don't want to do it because I'm like, why are you like I'm autonomous. I can make my own decisions. I can decide what I want to do. And that's very hard in work. Context because
I want to know where that comes from as well.
I cannot put my finger on like where in my childhood did I decide to just start rebelling against
something happened. Something
we've got to look
happened.
Into that.
Yeah, we both got to go back.
Psychology session on that
I
one.
I kind of want to do it now, but it's going to take us off track.
Yeah.
So it's the honesty, it's the being authentic, asking questions, looking after your health, understanding the value of and the importance of having the good relationship. So like I remember when I was in that phase where I felt pressured by my parents, like when I moved out, I was like, I am so glad to be out of there. Like, I just don't want to be near my parents. I don't want to talk to them. Don't call me. And then obviously completely flipped. Yeah. Now I see my parents all the time. We talk all the time. Really grateful. Yeah. Great relationship.
And that's just growing up.
That's growing up.
Too.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But I think that, you know, understanding that we're all on the same team. Like it's not you against your parents. You're not fighting because we're all on the same team. We're all the best for each other.
In a relationship context, and you don't have to say anything that, you know, is not comfortable on an open platform because Carly's obviously not in the room, but What do you think is kind of like the key to making monogamous relationships work? Because, I mean, you've been together for 7 years, so it probably just feels very normal and your parents are still together. But I think there's this growing trend that people are scared of commitment. Maybe with social media, there's like, there's always something better out there. There's always the notion that like, I can find something better and I don't want to like commit to building this thing that's amazing. That's got real substance to it. I just see so many friends who are like anti-relationship. They want kids, they want potentially a partner, but they don't want to do the marriage and the house and the like standard order that we've been conditioned to believe we should be doing. For you, was that ever anything, like was that ever something that you're like, I don't really want that? Or you've just always wanted a monogamous relationship, I guess I'm curious.
Okay, so the marriage part, yeah, we're both sort of in the same book here, which is Carly is probably a little bit traumatized because she worked for Alex Perry as a dressmaker. Ooh. And she's seen a lot of brides and she's seen a lot of weddings, and maybe there's just a little bit of stress there.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure.
Right. Not saying she doesn't want to get married, but if we were to get married, it would be so small. It would be
a bit of an elopement.
It would be barefoot in the sand with our close family. With Danny, exactly.
He'd deliver
the ring. Yeah, exactly. Not anti-marriage, but also don't see the reason why. And it's also like, why am I spending tens of thousands of dollars on this party? I don't even like parties. I don't want to
do a trip.
I don't want to go on a party. I hate being the center of attention. I hate it. Even birthdays, I don't want to be the center of attention in this party where everyone's there for me. I don't like that.
Cringe.
Yeah, a bit cringe. So, but I'm not anti-wedding. It's got to be right.
Right. Context. Right.
The relationship side of things, prerequisite. You have to be, I think, I might be wrong, I'm not a relationship expert. You got to be best friends. Because most of your relationship isn't the intimacy, the sex, the
spending time together.
It's hanging out with somebody. So you got to be best friends. You got to respect one another. I think you need your strengths to be her weaknesses and her
That's
vice versa,
so true.
To be your strengths. Because I know my weaknesses. And if I was in a relationship with someone who had the same weaknesses and the same strengths as me, no growth. So I've made like some pretty solid steps in that way. Hopefully Carly has as well. But I think, you got to be compatible in terms of what are your values and interests. Like if I was a carnivore and Carly's an ethical vegan, I don't see that working, right? Even if we loved each other.
It's a proper value thing.
To me, I know that you are not your diet and it's not your label, but it does say a lot about who you are and what your values are, right? So I think if I was like a meathead, I don't think it would work.
Yeah, that's fair.
So we have compatibility in terms of our ethics and values. We have respect for one another. We enjoy each other's company. We're best friends. And we have the physical, intimacy part of it. So,
and it's a choice, but it sounds like at the point of 7 years, I imagine it's a choice to be together and build this thing. It's not like it's just working because it's working.
Right.
There's probably some quite challenging times where you have to decide, like, this is what we want, this
Definitely.
Is what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me because I feel like we're just in this generation, maybe it's the people I'm surrounded by, like very career focused, very ambitious, particularly women. And I find that women who have that quote unquote masculine energy, like they're in their masculine. There's this whole rhetoric at the moment around that. The fact that it's not conducive to romantic relationships because women aren't kind of meant to be independent in that way to allow a relationship to flourish. Because it's a conversation I've literally had with Simon. It's like if a woman is very, very hyper independent, it emasculates you as a man because you don't know what you can provide.
Right.
Is that like, do you think that's fair in saying that that's how men might feel?
Yeah, I'm sure some men do. I personally do. I like the idea of having somebody in my life
independent person.
Fuck yeah. I mean, I also like the idea of building a partnership, but I also, I hope that if I would just disappear out of the picture, I would leave behind an independent person who can fend for themselves. Like, I don't want them to be fully dependent on me. That's kind of gross.
Yeah.
I want my partner to be.
And vice versa.
Yeah, and vice versa. Yeah. So, I think that's definitely a big part of it.
It's interesting. Let's do some rapid fire before we wrap up. You can kind of just, if you can, summarize clear answers for people that are listening that it might be kind of health conscious or curious, because you've obviously, you're a wealth of knowledge and you've got a lot of resources. We'll link your website and your courses and everything as well. If someone's listening and they are newly diagnosed as diabetic, what would you say to them?
I would say, number one, do not let perfection get in the way of progress, because it's so hard to manage. You're never going to be perfect. If you are a perfectionist or somebody who really is obsessive with getting everything right, fuck, you got to surrender. Let that go. It's not going to happen.
It's a bit of a like spiritual journey, isn't it?
Yeah, 100% will change you. You have to surrender. It's not good. At least like try your best always to manage it and stay on top of it. But if it is, for whatever reason, a little bit out of control, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility to try your best, right? So just surrender to that. You're not going to be perfect. Be willing to self-experiment. Try everything. Ask questions. Mm. Don't just, you know, stick to the first thing that you're told. Figure it out for yourself. Walk the walk. Like really give it a go. Experiment as much as you can. Mm. So, and then the last part, which goes on sort of attached to that, is you have to have a lifelong learner mindset.
Yeah.
Always going to learn. Even 12 years in, I'm still learning.
Even not just with diabetes, like that should just be part of our humanity, is like wanting to always learn and grow and be curious, right, and be a lifelong learner in all aspects of life, because I think that's why we're here. Like, right, we're meant to be absorbing and learning and becoming better people.
Yes. And the exclamation point on that is don't forget to enjoy the process.
Mm.
Because if you spend your whole life feeling like you're working this full-time job that you hate and never signed up for, you're going to resent it.
Mm.
So find a way to just enjoy the process. And that probably comes down to having good family,
relationships,
yeah, fall in love with the little things. Like,
yeah, if you're single, you can still have gratitude for like beautiful moments in the day and nature and delicious food,
exactly,
that you might be able to like eat with friends,
right,
or, you know.
Or a swim and then sit in the sun and drink a coffee. Like, mm, or take your dog for a
small
walk.
Things.
Like, those are the small things. That's life
actually
to me.
Big things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would be my high-level advice.
All right, rapid fire. What is the number one mistake that we make, humans in general, with our diet?
Spend way too much time on Instagram and TikTok listening to 15-year-olds giving advice that are not qualified, have no idea what they're talking about.
I wish I could drop this mic.
Seriously. Stop listening to TikTok nutritionists.
Fuck.
As in self-proclaimed nutritionists who are actually 15-year-olds who don't know what they're talking about.
I'm going to be devil's advocate here, but maybe don't listen to any nutritionist online because you don't actually understand
unless
what their biases are. Questionable. No. I mean, maybe work with someone who knows you on a personal level and can tailor advice to you. I think there's an amazing amount of advice out there, but like might not be absorbing it in the right context for that individual.
The biggest mistake people are making are they're falling for the tagline of this is what your doctor doesn't want you to know. This is the secret to XYZ. They don't want you to hear this, but I will tell you the answer. Like,
it's
all
the biggest
of that
marketing gag of all time. I literally saw, I won't name a teeth whitening company,
I'll name
say,
them.
I think we know these guys. I don't
everyone knows.
This is the teeth whitening ingredient that big corporations don't want you to know about. And someone commented and said, are we really pulling that line with teeth whitening?
Right. Like, as soon as you hear that line,
run.
Scroll. Go, move. Yeah. Just throw your phone away. Just burn it.
Leave. Go to Mars.
Leave it. So that's the mistake. Mm. People are falling for this stuff. And is it their fault? Probably not their fault. But again, it's your responsibility to actually figure out a way to navigate this terrain.
I was going to ask the same question in relation to what some mistakes we're making with our exercise, but I think we can apply that
exact same
concept. Another one that I want to know is, what is the number one mistake you have made on your journey, or something you could rectify if you could go back and it would kind of save you a bit of heartache and pain?
Number one mistake was getting attached to the first thing that worked.
Mm.
So when I discovered that exercise was this amazing tool to manage diabetes, I was obsessed with exercise to the point where I was like, I'm just going to use this as the tool and I'm not going to do the insulin properly.
Yeah, that's like the cure.
Yeah. And there's no such thing. Mm. So getting attached and being willing to go, you know what, just because it's the first thing that worked and just because it works now doesn't mean it's going to work forever. I might have to pivot.
So true.
So you've got to just go, great, use it while you can. Find out how to use it properly and responsibly and balanced, but don't just stick to the first thing that works. It's same thing happened with my diet. Keto worked for 2 months. At 4 months, it wasn't working. And if I just stuck to that, think about what would happen. So don't get attached.
Such valuable advice. Change is the only constant.
Yes.
Where do you think we go after we die?
Well, I think if you have done anything meaningful in your life, the legacy lives on, or the spirit lives on. Like, there's no, I can still feel my grandma when I drive past her street, right? And that's because she had a family and has offspring and was an amazing spirit. If she was alone, I would argue that spirit is not absorbed by anyone else. So I think it depends on what you do in your life.
Can you define your belief system in with a label? Do you have a specific religion or belief system you stand by?
No, I do not.
Are you spiritual at all?
Yeah, but
because you're very science based.
Yeah, no, I am a little bit spiritual. I'm definitely more scientific.
Mm.
Am I spiritual? I think I am. But I wouldn't be able to label it. I don't know what it is.
That's kind of like...
Don't know what it is.
The crux of it, isn't it? You can't define it. You can't define this energy.
Do you think you can if I... What?
Yeah, well, I have had someone say, what is energy? And I'm like, that's just a ridiculous question because are we thinking scientifically or are we thinking about personal experiences?
Yes.
I'm not religious. I'm highly spiritual based on my experiences with what I call energy, which some people call God, some people call the universe, some people call Allah, Buddha. I think they're all the same. I think they're a representation of something that is bigger than us that we can't quite define and we can't put our finger on, but it's the tangible nature of existence that is just there, quite frankly. Like if you want to lean into it, it's there for you. Mm. But I think there's all this kind of like ridiculous conversation around religion and belief systems and this polarization of like, this is right. No, this is right. I genuinely think that it's all the same.
Mm.
It's all the same. It's like whether you're a Christian or you're a Buddhist, like it's the same principles of be a good human and spread love and look after your neighbor and do good with your life. Like it's actually at a core level. I've literally read the Quran because I'm like, I want to know, is it the same sort of principles? And it's when you strip it back, it's
that's really very interesting. Similar. Yeah, we're probably all just labeling the same thing in a different way based on our beliefs.
And I've come from a family, I was going to say this at the start of our conversation, where you said your parents kind of were very open to you discovering what felt right for you in terms of diet and exercise and whatnot, and they weren't dogmatic. My parents were very much like that with spirituality and religion. My mum's very intuitive and my dad is non-religious, and they literally just said, do what you like, like discover what works for you. I said I wanted to go to church when I was 10 because I was curious. They let me go with like an older relative. They were just like, you figure out what feels right. And I think that's why I have such a strong connection to spirituality, quote unquote, because I have allowed it to like develop within me, and through my own experiences, I've like solidified what that means to me. Yeah. So bit of a tangent. I don't think I could define it, but I like certainly pray or manifest or visualize or do things that feel right to me, but not to a specific God, just to something greater.
And I think that everyone's looking for something to guide them, right? And it doesn't matter what it is or what you call it. As long as you feel like there's a vision or a path or a purpose, you're going to find happiness way quicker.
100%. And some people feel that leaning into science and the fact that we don't go anywhere after we die, we literally die and we're nothing.
Yeah.
That brings in peace. And I say, if that works for you and that brings greater urgency to your life, then that's good too.
Right. That's exactly.
It doesn't matter.
I mean, that's exactly what I was just saying. I believe in both. So I think that if you have not done anything impactful or left a legacy of any sort, that you do literally go into the ground and disappear. But if you have created incredible connections and bonds and created life, your spirit lives on.
Totally.
And you feel it. Like I still feel it. You know what I mean? So
hello to Drew's grand.
Yes.
She's here right now. Thank you so much. We finish every episode with the same closing tradition. All the guests are asked the same question. And we kind of just went into that territory, but you can answer in as many or as little words that you like. But that question is, Drew, what is the meaning of life?
I love how you go, we finish with this, just really like just quick fire answer this question. The biggest question ever. What is the meaning of life?
That's this podcast.
I know, I like it. Okay. Oh, this is going to be a bland answer.
Trust.
Okay. The meaning of life is simply to try live in each moment this is the meaning of my life.
What's the meaning of your life?
Make the most of every single moment so that it can make you a better person to have that domino effect. The more good people we have in the world, the better this world will be. So the first place to start is to appreciate each and every single moment and just pass it on.
You think that's cringy, but I think that's beautiful. And you would be surprised if a few other people have said something very, very similar. So it shows that you're very aligned and you kind of know that there's greater meanings. So
it's a big question to end on.
That's why we're here. People laugh. It's like, oh, the meaning of life. I'm like, well, what else should we be talking about? This is literally what I want to know. Like,
it's true.
What's your meaning? So thanks for being here.
You've
been incredible. And we will link everyone to your resources in the show notes. You have some amazing guides and free education on multiple platforms. So we'll pop it all in the show notes. And thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. That was really fun. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love to hear from next, or if you have a story to share, I'd love to get in touch with you. You can connect directly with me on Instagram at lifechatspodcast, one word. And every review and share really does help so much in the early days of building a podcast. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it on social media, or you can snap a pic of where you might be listening and jump onto Apple Podcasts and give us a review. I really do appreciate the support more than you know. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, or evening wherever you may be listening in the world. I'm Georgia May, and this is Life Chats.